Now we're into the whole subject of crucifixion, and there's a lot to it. The pivotal issues we're going to look at here. In chapter 26, that's the time of the Passover, and the Pharisees were going to get him crucified. I mean, they were going to do that job. They had by then had made up their minds. So it says in verse 4, they consulted to they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. Now, verse 5 is gutty. It's pivotal. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. In the first place, they were very assiduous about not killing Jesus at the wrong time and observing the Passover and all of these things and following the law, but destroying the one who came to fulfill the law. And the line is a classic, where it says that they not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. Gospels say that the common people heard Jesus gladly. So it was a private club of the leadership, the religious leaders, who were more Satan-oriented than Christ-oriented. I don't think they had anything much to do with God. I think that God was a figurehead to them and an identity point for the people. But personally, they were just into their religious activities, and they, of course, were the leaders. That's where their big interest was. It was nothing really spiritual, but they wanted control of the people. So they were fearful about taking Jesus on the feast day because there'd be an uproar. All right, now in verses 6 through 9, there's another pivotal point. These are all insights into our ultimate identity with Christ. You know, after all, we're sitting down here on the earth. We are earthlings. And we are talking about identifying with the God of the universe. That's a big order. It's a big leap. How do we bridge that gap? And no matter how religious you are, or one is, or how many religious observances, or how perfect, or whatever, you still have that big gap to bridge between the reality of God and the facade of earth. The philosophers all try to bridge it, that is, the theistic philosophers. You know, there are branches of philosophy that are identified with theistic philosophy. Classic philosophers of the centuries were what they call a theistic philosopher. That is, they believed in God and they were setting forth proofs for the existence of God. And a lot of that theistic philosophy had to do with philosophers thinking out the impact of God and presenting proofs for him. But in all the philosophic proofs, for example, Kant, Immanuel Kant, says that the fact that there's an idea of God in our heads argues for God, because where else will we get such an idea? You don't see God in anybody around you, I take it. I mean, your husbands, wives, they don't look like God to you, do they? Where do you find a role model for a God who on the earth could ever be identified with the things that people usually ascribe to God? So, but they have one great problem, and that is bridging the gap between thought and reality. How do you get God into reality? You can talk about it, you can present all kinds of proofs for the existence of God, but how do you really get him into reality? Now, as I've pursued this subject for 100 years, more or less, plus or minus a few, I've run into every kind of possible attitude and philosophy and option available. And in the end, of course, all the lists of proofs. How do you know God exists? Or how do you know he cares about you? And all these things, you see. And they're all words. And they're all based upon human idiocies. I mean, all humans are insane, one way or another. We're all nuts. So, whole thing. How's your banana boat lately? You know, well, you know, when you really stop to think about it, what we think in this world is pretty idiotic. When you compare it to what the actuality of God in the universe is, what reality is, what we think is screwy. Now, how do we bridge that? Simple way. The Spirit of God within us gives reality to God that our brain can't give him. And thus, when we see all the reasons why it's absurd to believe in God, you know, list them. They're all out there. The absurdities that have to do with how come one city gets hit with a hurricane and another one escapes, or you know, all these things that you look at and you say, why does this happen if there's a God and so on? But over against all of that human thinking, which is, of course, very minuscule, very minute, for us to think about what God is doing is really like, well, let's be generous and say a grasshopper trying to outguess the gardener. What's he going to do next, the gardener? Grasshopper's perched on his little posy or wherever he is, and he's wondering, where is the old gardener going to strike next? Now, it's absurd for us to think that the grasshopper is thinking like that. He doesn't even have the element or cavity in his brain to do that kind of thinking. The issue we're looking at is, how do we get God into reality? And I'm saying that all the human words are really not a whole lot more than a few grunts of a chimpanzee, right? Compared with the language of God, if you will. We think thoughts about God, and as he directs our thinking, we have something to work with, but ultimately the understanding of all these processes on earth has got to be with God. Now, the bridge here between God and or the reality of God and the great chasm between God and man, the bridge is the Spirit, who has, irrespective of all of our own personal inadequacies, somehow drawn us together to this place to hear things about him. And I've always said, of course, that's the key to bridging the chasm, is the Spirit of God touching us within, that in spite of all the evidences of the contrary, there is still that identity with God, and there is the assumption that out there somewhere God is going to pull it all into focus. I've used the analogy of the eaves on the roof of a house, and you've got your eaves on each side of the roof, and standing on the ground you may see only the eaves plus 50 feet of separation. And you ask yourself, how in the world can this ever meet? But 10 feet up in the air, it meets. You don't see that, theoretically. You're just looking at it from the ground. So we have theological ideas about God, and we have events in the world that we can say really don't show any compatibility at all or consistency. Why does this happen? Why does this happen? And the confidence is that up there somewhere, those things are going to meet together. Those episodes are going to be meaningful to us. But at the present time, they may be very distressing, maybe very painful. I don't know if you've ever been involved in surgery, for example, or some kinds of physical ailments that are painful, like arthritis and things of that type. Let us say, however, that you've got a problem, some kind of cancer, for example. The surgeon is going to go in and cut it out, and you go through a period of considerable pain. distress. Ultimately, however, it is for our good. See? Ultimately. That's the way it is with the identity with Christ. Things that have to be done on the earth, which we don't understand at all, ultimately will work out to His glory and to our benefit. But now we don't understand it. I've always said that God has a greater stake in this world than most people imagine, and a greater assurance of victory. The way a lot of people talk, and I got a letter this week from a woman, or last week from a woman who talked like this, and we have our little precious few up here, and there are a lot of people who think that they're going to be God's little group, a chosen few, and everybody else is going to be down the drain. And people take the passage in the Gospels about the tree at cherry-picking time where there's one cherry out in the outermost bough, you know, a very scattered fruit. And they think that that has to do with Christians. They think that has to do with God's ministry in the world. But after all, if whether the people are dead or not, if Satan has the larger share, he won a victory. Just keep that in mind. And I think that we have a very large area of misunderstanding in terms of what God is going to do ultimately with the world He made. We think to ourselves, how could God bring people into this world only to have them go astray and wind up in hell and suffer torment for the rest of the eternity? Well, I'm going to have to say to you, I'm not sure it's like that at all. I'm not a universalist in the sense I think everybody, no matter who they are or what they do, are going to be saved. But I think it's going to be a very large recovery on God's part that is not understood by others. Now, you can read that specifically in Romans 9 through 11, for example. What God is going to do with the Gentiles. And you can read it in Psalm 68, for example, where the vision of the end times sees people from Egypt and from the south, they're bringing offerings to Jerusalem. The Gentiles, joining with the Jews who remain on the earth after the church is taken out. So I have to say to you, God is not going to wipe out His great creation with one nuclear blast. You know, you think to yourself, well, we're all that bad. Why doesn't He just wipe the whole thing out? But He's got a lot more in His pocket than that. So the thing that we have, well, of course, we cannot, with our human minds, assess that any more than, as I have said, a maybe 4-year-old child or 5-year-old child, no matter how smart they are, can really understand how it is that the system of economics works in the world. And father goes to the work and gets checks. I mean, try explaining to a 5-year-old child the process of income tax. Adults get confused. Well, you sit down with your 5-year-old child and say, now look, I'd like to read the instructions on income tax to you. Now just settle down here. I'll give you a glass of milk. I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to read this to you and explain it. You're not going to make it. Forget it. By the same token, if we try to sit down and figure out what God is doing with us or with the world, you know, why did you allow this, God? You know, what is us all about? And all we can do is to be at peace in the fact that in spite of all that, we still hang in there. There's an inner something that says, whatever it is, it's going to work out all right. I mean, God has His way of handling this world. That is, we start with the thesis that whatever goes down, God is going to handle it one way or another. Now, we come to this passage in chapter 26, where Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. And there came to Him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointments and poured it on his head as he sat at meat. But when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, "To what purpose is this waste? For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor." Now, John has the same story, few different items in it, but I think it's the same incident. Incidentally, this is one of the great proofs for the inspiration of Scripture, the discrepancy between John's account and Matthew's account. A great proof for the validity of the Scripture. Because there was no effort here to manipulate the words and bring them into harmony. They need to say, this is, let's get our story straight, boys. You know, or let's, this is how it is when you have some witnesses to an accident or something. Okay, let's get our story straight. We all say the same thing. No effort to do that. But I think the Spirit took the mind of each one of the writers and gave it through them in terms of their perspective. And you take a dozen people in an accident, they'll all see it differently. The central issue is that it was a very, very expensive perfume, or ointment, rather. It says 300 denarii. That would be a year's wages. You know, in those days, a denarius was a day's wages. Now, what would it buy? I don't know. What would 15 cents buy in 1945? Gallon of gasoline. Can you imagine buying a gallon of gasoline for 15 cents? Okay. All right, so the disciples were incensed. Now, it was Judas that was really the one that was incensed. And John says that he was incensed because he held the money bags. He was the treasurer of the organization, and he wanted that money for his treasury, really. He didn't really care about the poor. But you see, why wasn't this sold and the money used for the poor? And this passage says that when the disciples were incensed that that money was wasted by pouring it on Jesus, and it says this might have been sold for much and given to the poor. When Jesus understood it, he said to them, "Why trouble ye the woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon us. For you have the poor always with you, but me you have not always." And he says, "For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say to you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this that this woman hath done be told for a memorial of her." Now, Mother Teresa could have such a promotion. But you see, the point was not that Jesus doesn't care for the poor, but I think he understands the economics of the world. I will say this to you, as far as economics is concerned, as far as the feeding the poor is concerned, or the homeless. I know people that have worked with and are currently working with welfare agencies. And you take a couple that walks in the door of the welfare agency and has no place to go, they are going to pay for a motel room to put them up. You walk into the Salvation Army, they're not going to send you out into the cold. They're going to put you up somewhere. But especially the public welfare agencies will see that this couple has a place to sleep, even if they have to pay for it out of their coffers. The truly homeless, you know, I saw in a paper this morning, this great march for the homeless, was fundamentally that people who can't afford to buy a house could buy one. See, a lot of people in this country cannot afford to buy a house. I can't afford to buy a house. You know, how many people can afford to buy a house? We may have to get realistic in America and settle for what the French have and the Germans and all. How many people in France own a house? The whole city of Paris is apartments, you know, you rent. It's part of your income, renta. The word for that. Where we get our word rent from. That's part of their budget. They rent. Part of their income is given to rent. All right, another point is there are an awful lot of questions about the homeless factor. Many of the people, I've talked this with people who are in the welfare program. Many of the people we call a perennially homeless, I mean the absolute homeless, choose that either because they choose the booze, you know, and they, one fellow, for example, illustrates this who found out that he was heir to a very large amount of money. I mean, we're talking $500,000, something like that, something that would set him up for the rest of his life. He turned it down because he preferred to live under the viaduct there where he'd been living. See? A lot of these people have dropped out. They don't want to mix with society. They don't want the responsibilities of money. And so, not that I'm saying there isn't a problem for homeless, but Jesus was a realist. He could have spent his whole life on the earth feeding the hungry, housing the homeless. He didn't even have a house himself. But one of the crucial issues of this temptation factor is right here. Because had Jesus succumbed to Satan's suggestion that he turn a stone into bread. Now, can you imagine how he would be hounded? He would become the celestial baker. He'd bring truckloads of rock to Jesus so he could turn it into bread, and he'd spend all his life turning rocks into bread. But it could have sidetracked him into that. Or he could have been sidetracked into the miracle issue. Jump off the temple and God will catch you. It would all be spectacular. People have no thought whatever for their spirits. It would be for the miraculous events, to jump off the temple, for example. But the point about the bread is, Jesus could have made a stone into bread, but he'd have spent the rest of his life feeding people bread instead of doing the job he was supposed to do. Now, there are people in the business of feeding the hungry and housing the homeless. And there are people like the Union Rescue Mission, for example. I've told you about it. I've spoken for them over the air many times, spoken in their chapel many, many times. I've been an old friend of the Union Rescue Mission for the last 50 years. Well, I send people there. They're geared for that. They understand those things. They're set up for it. They know just how long they can house a man before he needs to get out. They know just all this stuff. They know that. That's their gift. And I think their gift is a wonderful gift. And I have no qualms about that. I don't say, why don't you guys sell this dump and go out on the road and preach? No, I think they're doing what they have to do. But that's not my calling, see. Similarly, I could have spent my whole life involved with the drug addicts. And we had a lot of success with them, but that's not my calling. That wasn't what I have to do. And Jesus' calling at this point was not to go out and feed the hungry, but to save the world. And that's what, of course, he did. But it's an interesting parallel here, this Matthew account versus the John account. And in John's account, of course, Judas is the Betnoir, the rascal, and it says in John 13 that Jesus called Judas on it, and it said from that moment Satan entered into Judas, and he became controlled by, ultimately, Satan. I look at some of the dictators of today, like Noriega is the most recent. The bad guy. I would say the man was almost certainly demonically possessed, demon possessed. The interesting thing is that Satan is a great swindler. When Noriega finally comes to the end of his rope, he may stand before his mentor, Satan, and be chagrined, be chagrined to find that Satan had used him. And he doesn't care about him. He's to the furnace with him. but you know, I'm the one that did all your bidding to the furnace. The interesting thing, these fellows don't realize that someday they're going to have to die. How long is Noriega, has he got? At best, what, 20 more years? They'll go by very swiftly if he lives to that, to his regular old natural age. But after all this lifetime of oppressing and badgering and hurting the people, what will his lot be? He doesn't stop to think of that. Although I think he may think more of it than people realize. I think I may have mentioned about this one very leading young drug pusher who was making thousands of dollars a week, according to a story in the magazine I was reading. But he came to the end of that because it just got so bad, wondering what's going to happen next. How many people were out there after his hide or after his job? And he had to keep looking over his shoulder all the time. It was such a bad scene, it didn't matter if he had money coming out of his ears. Here's Noriega, all the power and all the money and all the rest of it. All of a sudden, he's a zero. But they don't stop to think of that at all. Anyway, here was Judas, who became imbued with Satan there at the Lord's, the Last Supper, as we call it. Satan entered into him, and from then on, he was just a marionette, a puppet, doing the bidding of the devil. And then, of course, you know, he went out and hung himself. There again, a couple of accounts. One says that he fell and burst asunder from a high place. But you see, you've got both possibilities. He's maybe hung, but dropped off and into the canyon there. Whatever it was, he came to a terrible end. Satan has no mercy at the end for his most faithful servants. They go mad. You know, they go... Like Herod, for example, eaten with worms. The end of these people is bitter. Hallucinations and paranoia. A guy like that's got to realize that there could be a dozen plots against him in the very walls of his own palace. Terrible life. On the surface, people think, here's a fellow with power, and all he has to do is push this button and that, and he's got all the money he wants and everything. It's a terrible life. Terrible life. So, Judas, possessed by Satan, went out and did the business, betrayed Jesus, went out and hung himself. He, in fact, cast the silver back at their feet and said, here, take your money, I don't want it. Went out and hung himself. It's a great contest between God and Satan, and Satan has his puppets out there that willingly identify with him and then get themselves into terrible hot water. The story has a lot of insights into things that Jesus received this alabaster perfume, blessed the woman who did it, and did not listen to her detractors. Now, Christ has in mind whatever it is he wants to do with this world, and of course, as you know, the feeding of the 5,000, the 4,000 was a great, what shall I say, hint or prelude or preface to what he was going to do. That he could take these two loaves and five loaves and two little fish and feed the whole assembly with them was a manifest token of what he can do and will do to handle his place in the world, to handle the world. and to handle ourselves. So what do? You just be at peace, trust the Lord day by day to help you get through things and to do what you're supposed to do. Leave it with Him. You're not going to be able to handle it yourself, you know. We can't even handle it. You know, there's a lot of people talk about fighting Satan, the battle with Satan. I want to say something to you about that. For my part, when it comes to fighting Satan, I'm chicken. I'm not going to get in a ring with Satan. You know, we're battling all the time, but not in my own strength, see? If this is a test, forget the test, just write zero, you know. I'm not gonna ever admit or guarantee that I'm gonna handle Satan. I can't. It's an unfair fight. Because he's got all his particular kind of power. I don't have any power. You know, Lord has to do the job. It's a matter of human beings trying to gear up for the battle. You can't gear up for the battle. It's like an Indian fighting the Gatling gun of the Old West. You know, you can have 10 arrows in your quiver. You go up against a Gatling gun, you're a goner. That's like we were Indians up against a Gatling gun when it comes to fighting Satan. He's got more ways to wipe you out than you can ever think of defending yourself against. Like I said to a young lady about arguing with your parents, you know. Don't fight with your parents. Be submissive and open, because they've got more ways to shut you down than you can ever imagine. Justly or unjustly. They can shut you down. They can cut your water off and you're dry. You have to look at it. A lot of people think they're going to get the strength from God to fight Satan. They're going to get grace from God, but the strength is His. So immediately, you know, say uncle. I always do, uncle. That's it. But He has ways to handle it that we don't know about. We stumble along on the earth. We don't do everything all the way we should. We do some things well and some things not so well. But in the end, it's only Christ that can really handle Satan. Once Judas let Satan come in, he was a goner. He was then railroaded right into the pit. Well, I think we're going to stop there.